but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the Pack West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Have you ever been, like, in front of a zip line with friends, and you kind of look at the zip line, and you go to your friend, you go, well, who's going to go first? And then somebody always raises their hand and says, I'll go first. Or maybe you've been in a swimming pool, and there's a high dive on it, and you climb up to the high dive with your best friend as a kid, and then you go, you go first. You want to see what's going to happen. UCLA went first. 0-3 start. Deshaun Foster, who, by the way, was set up for failure. We're going to get into this. Set up for failure when UCLA hired him. Deshaun Foster has been fired after 15 games of coaching UCLA. Not equipped, not prepared, had never been a play caller, had never been a head coach. As figureheads go, Deshaun Foster, a nice ambassador for UCLA, beloved by the fans, but not at all prepared to be a head football coach in college football. He played professionally as a running back for 6 seasons in the NFL. UCLA fans love him. But UCLA was not a good football team, but Deshaun Foster is the coach. Mountain West Conference, New Mexico, boat raced UCLA over the weekend and made $1.3 million, picked up a check in order for their trouble. They were like, hey, we'll get the check and we'll take the W. Jason X team upsetting UCLA. They were a double-digit underdog. UCLA looked hapless in the fourth quarter. UCLA fans upset. The athletic director at UCLA, Martin Jarmon, who promoted Deshaun Foster after Chip Kelly left, is taking some heat now, understandably so and justifiably so. I know Martin Jarmon. We've had him on the show a number of times. I, in fact, met with Martin Jarmon not long after he promoted Deshaun Foster. It was a couple of summers ago. I was in Indianapolis for the Big Ten Media Day, and I was at my hotel, and I went to get coffee, and he was sitting in the coffee shop. So I sat with him for a while, and we talked. We talked about Chip Kelly's departure. We talked about his promotion of Deshaun Foster. He kind of pointed to UCLA football, and he said, you know, it's not like we've had all this great success in football, and he really kind of talked like a guy who had been put in a bad spot when he promoted Deshaun Foster. And there may be some truth to that. But I also asked him at the time, I said, you know, Jonathan Smith jumped from Oregon State to Michigan State. And he did it like a guy who was thinking like, hey, any port in the storm. I just got to get out of this. I got to get to any port in the storm. And Jonathan Smith jumps to Michigan State. Probably makes a mistake because the UCLA job opens after that. The Washington job opens after that. And I think Jonathan Smith would have, those are better jobs than going to Michigan State. But I think he would have jumped at it. I said to Martin Jarmon at the time, I said, you know, if you're making this hire and Jonathan Smith is out there, how hard are you looking at him? And he goes, if he's out there, Washington's probably hiring him. And he says, of course I would have looked at him. They would have looked for somebody with head coaching experience. Instead, they got Deshaun Foster. And at that very same media day, Deshaun Foster took the stage and pretty much indicated to the world that he was not ready to be a head football coach.
How you guys doing? I'm happy to be here. Glad to be a part of this great conference. Finally putting two great emblems together, UCLA and the Big Ten. We're a school that's won, what, 123 championships, so this fits us being right in this conference. Football-wise, we're just excited. You know, I'm sure you guys don't know too much about UCLA, but our football program, but we're in L.A. It's us and USC. I'm just basically excited, really. That's it. Any questions?
There he was, the guy who told us that UCLA was in L.A., has been fired by UCLA. Deshaun Foster. And it wasn't his fault that day. I felt bad for him. And I turned to the media relations person at UCLA who was kind of ushering players around that day. And I said, hey, you guys should have got him some help. I put this on the athletic director, Martin Jarmond. I put this on the sports information department, who put a head football coach up there who really wasn't prepared to take the stage, didn't have any notes, didn't really know what it was about, had never been in that setting as a head coach before. Put him up on the stage, and you got, like, you know, Dan Lanning and others who were walking up there with notes, Jonathan Smith. Jonathan Smith was nervous when he went up there for Michigan State, but he had notes to lean on, and he'd been in front of the room before. And so it was just a really bad start for Deshaun Foster, and then a 5-10 record in 15 games, a couple of Mountain West teams beating him. And that is that. UCLA now says that they are going to pivot. Martin Jarmond did a news conference yesterday. He spoke to reporters and said that they are going to they're going to have a committee. This, to me, is the worst idea ever. That's all we need is another committee. We need another committee to come up with hiring the next football coach at UCLA. Let's form a committee. That's what everybody always does. Form a committee to talk about the playoff. Let's form a committee to talk about whether or not college sports wagering should be allowed in the state of Oregon. Let's form a committee. Let's have a meeting about a meeting. So that what? So that you can make this hire bulletproof is what they're trying to do. Martin Jarmond doesn't want to get fired. And so the AD at UCLA is saying, we're going to huddle up the key stakeholders, all of the big donors, some influential people like Troy Aikman at UCLA, and the Wasserman family. And we're going to let them tell us who to hire. In case it doesn't work out, then it's not on me. And that is not leadership, okay? That is not at all leadership. That is the worst, lamest idea I've ever heard. Bill Moose, the former athletic director at Washington State and Nebraska and Oregon, reached out to me. I wrote that today at johncanzano.com, and he wrote me, and he said, I loved your comments about the UCLA approach in selecting the new coach. And remember, when Paul Wolf was fired at the end of the 2011 season at Washington State, Bill Moose was asked in a news conference, who's going to be on the selection committee? You know what his response was? You're looking at it, buddy. That's it. Mike Leach. While everybody else was putting together committees, Bill Moose was on his way to Key West to hire Mike Leach. It can be lonely at the top. These athletic directors and leaders and presidents will tell you it is a lonely place to be, because sometimes it is on you. Sometimes it's your butt that's under the fire. But you can't do this committee thing. I don't think Jarmond's going to survive this. Bill Plaschke, LA Times columnist, went after him yesterday in print. They owe him about $6 or $8 million. It's a lot of money for an AD, but I don't think he ultimately survives it. I think they may push him to the background as the athletic director and let somebody else call the shots. And he can sort of just be the de facto, press AD and talk to media, but not really make the decisions. But that is not leadership at UCLA. We're going to talk about it on today's show. What is leadership? What is leadership at the top of your football program? What is leadership at the top of your athletic department? What is leadership in a news conference? We're going to be all over that on today's show. Oregon State went to Lubbock, Texas, and got boat raced. We got to talk about it. Civil War week, we got to talk about it. It'll be the Beavers and the Ducks this weekend at Autzen Stadium. It'll be at Apple Cup with Washington and Washington State. Both of those games shaping up maybe to be ugly, as Washington State and Oregon State just didn't look very good over the weekend. They went to the state of Texas and got exposed. Meanwhile, the Ducks, they win at Northwestern, but the Gamblers are not happy because it's a 34-14 game where the Ducks gave up 14 points in the fourth quarter. Conspiracy theorists pointing at Dan Lanning going, he knows the point spread. I got news for you. Dan Lanning's just trying to manage the season. Dan Lanning's just trying to get out of games with guys healthy because he knows they could be playing 14 or 15 games this season. I don't think Dan Lanning's worried about the scoreboard. I think he's worried about, like, winning convincingly, although the AP voters punished Oregon for giving up those late points. slipping Georgia and slipping Miami in front of them in the AP top 25 poll. We also have a controversy for the second straight week in the AP poll. Brenna Green, who is a television reporter right here in the Portland market, messed her ballot up. But here's the difference. And I love what Brenna did. She's a good reporter. Brenna Green owned it, admitted she made a mistake. She accidentally, on no sleep, made a mistake, looked at South Carolina and looked at, poll and saw a score wrong. She thought South Carolina won the game 31-7. So, you know, she goes on social media and says, hey, unfortunately, I was on 4 hours of sleep. That's exactly what happened. I screwed up. I made a mistake. I owned it. I own it. I screwed up. Everybody moves on. That's how you handle it like a grown-up. Stephen Vaughn, you're in the hot seat. Where do you want to start today? Deshaun Foster out. Oregon still undefeated but slipping in the polls. An AP pollster admitting she made a mistake. Acting like a grown-up, where are we starting?
Yeah, I'll start with the AP poll. Yeah, I think Brenna Green did a great job. And, you know, South Carolina, they lose to Vanderbilt 31-7 at home, yet she keeps them in the top 10 at number 10, and everyone else basically has South Carolina out of the poll. And she does a great job of saying, look, I've been working all this time. I just overlooked it. And people were mad, but you look at a lot of those comments that they said, they're like, okay, that's understandable. At least you admitted it. At least you admit you're wrong and you understand what was happening. And that's all that we said that should Haley Sawyer should do last week was just be like, come out and say, whether you did it on purpose or not, just admit like, hey, you know what? I messed up here. That's my bad. I will be better next week. And people are going to forget about it and aren't going to hold grudges. Instead, Haley went on and just kept egging everybody on. So I thought Brenna Green did a great job. And again, they all make mistakes. John Wilner talked about that. They make mistakes.
Yeah. John Wilner left a team off his ballot altogether.
Right.
Like the 17th ranked team's not on his ballot.
Like, if you're going to vote, you're going to miss these spots. I think the AP needs to reevaluate their whole process at the end of the year because we are looking into this more and more. And with so much money involved in college football, John, I do think they need to reevaluate this whole process because everyone says the AP poll doesn't matter. It matters a lot. And so I think that they need to reevaluate that process. You talk about the Oregon Ducks. Yeah, I mean, it was a get-in, get-out type of situation. I thought Oregon had a very vanilla game plan on purpose. I don't think they wanted to show anything against Northwestern as you got Penn State coming up in 2 weeks. I think that they did get punished for not covering the spread, which is wild to me. But I tell you what, you and me both on the Ducks, or both on Northwestern. I mean, plus,
yeah. I saw that coming. You know how I saw it coming? I just thought, look, Oregon still hasn't really played anybody. Like, Northwestern very limited in what they can do. And Montana State, not that great. FCS team. And Oklahoma State might be the worst. It's a lot saying a lot with UCLA. It's one of the worst Power Four teams.
That's the game right there, Oklahoma State, UCLA.
I like to see Oklahoma State, UCLA, maybe Oregon State 2 weeks ago when they couldn't snap the ball in like a jamboree situation.
Yeah, triple threat.
How does that go?
I agree with you, and I thought Oregon, they did what they had to do. They got in, they got out, they got the win. You know, people stayed healthy. They didn't show much. So I thought it was a good win for Oregon, and I think Dan Lanning is very happy with what happened on Saturday. And then you talk about Sean Foster. My initial thought was like, that's the right choice. This needs to happen. My second thought was, this is exactly the same situation as Trent Brazen. Same exact record, 5-10 as a head coach. Oregon State has lost 9 out of 10 games now, going back to last season, and a lot of them have not even been close, and they have not been against the best of competitions. The Texas Tech game, John, I thought Oregon State had a chance to go out and prove something, show a little bit of heart, show a little bit of
showed
fight.
No heart.
They showed nothing. And Trent Bray addressed it after the game, saying, look, some of the guys weren't giving effort. That's not a good sign, in my opinion. When you're a head coach and you're 15 games in your career and you're already admitting, like, look, players aren't playing hard, that's a problem. I don't know if Trent Bray needs to be fired at this moment. I would probably say no at this moment. But I've got Oregon State buddies texting me like, this is horrible and he's got to go. This is peewee football. When they're running punts with Malik Murphy because they can't snap the football, that's peewee football. And it's embarrassing.
Yeah,
and
the way they were snapping the ball looked like Pop Warner.
And you look like a middle of the pack group of five team. And I understand that. And I've come to the realization now, look, Oregon State, you did a good job of trying to pose up as a Power Four team. You're just not. You're a Group of Five team, and now you got to be better than what you are. I think Trent Bray is strictly on the hot seat right now. You're not beating Oregon. I can't see him beating Houston. I mean, this could be an 0-7 start to the season.
Yeah, it really matters how they play, and they're not going to beat Oregon, but it matters how they play, and it matters how they play against Houston. And I think that is about the point where I will start to wonder if Scott Barnes will have to do something about Trent Bray. Keep in mind that the comparisons, the parallels with Deshaun Foster are amazing here, because it's literally that you get two coaches who leave. Chip Kelly leaves UCLA. Jonathan Smith leaves Oregon State. Leaves their school in a bad situation, a little bit of a lurch. At Oregon State, they do exactly what UCLA did. They go with the expedient, cheap, local hire, and then the games start, and suddenly you go, oh, these guys are not head coach material. The other thing that's interesting to me is Deshaun Foster. You heard it in that clip. He's not great in front of the room. He doesn't have that CEO polish. And people said to me at the time, because I put that on Instagram, I put it on TikTok. Yes, I have Instagram and TikTok. You should be following me there. I put it on Instagram and TikTok, and people said, oh, you're being unfair to Deshaun. You're just making fun of him. No. When this happened in the summer of 2024, I went, this is an indicator that he's not ready for this job. You have to have a certain amount of polish to be able to stand in front of media and donors and do your job as a head football coach. You have to act like a CEO. You have to have a certain amount of polish to go into a living room and recruit. Now, I think Deshaun Foster, local hero to the Bruins, and Trent Bray, like, you know, former linebacker at Oregon State, tough guy on the defense, both had continuity with the program, familiarity with the program. It seemed like the ADs at both schools liked him because, you know, these guys, you know the struggle we're in. Yes, we can get him cheaper. But both of them have struggled from a media standpoint, being in front of the room and having that polish. And I do wonder if you can't do that, if you can't connect with media, if you can't connect with recruits, if you can't connect with your fans, how are you connecting in your own locker room?
It really is eerie how similar these situations are. Like
Alma mater,
yep. Same exact record. The way that they're playing, like UCLA got pushed around by New Mexico. I thought they should have just gone across the field and got Jason Nick as their head coach right there. I mean, that's the thing. It's like,
Marvin Jarman walk across the field and just be like, you're hired.
Well, that's the question for Oregon State, John, and for me, as I'm getting, is like, can Oregon State go out and get a better coach than Trent Bray? Like, you fire that guy, you can live with him, you let him improve, or can you actually go out and get a better coach that wants to go to Corvallis and be that head coach? Is that a real thing?
Well, look around, like, kind of the upper echelon of the Mountain West Conference. If you look at Boise State, San Diego State, Fresno State, Utah State, Colorado State, you're not going and getting an established coach that can be hired in the Power Four. You're getting somebody like Sean Lewis, who's going to come on today's show at 4 o'clock at San Diego State. You're getting somebody like, you know, Jay Norvell at Colorado State. You're getting, you know, Spencer Danielson, a promotion at Boise State. You're getting kind of a younger head coach or somebody who's, you know, on the youngish side, who's trying to make their way as a head coach, and you're a stepping stone job to the Power Four conferences. I think Oregon State's thinking, and I remember talking to Scott Barnes at the time, Oregon State's thinking was, hey, this gives us some continuity. Now, the only other coach that I think they were serious about was Brett Brennan, who was at Arizona. And I can tell you, I talked with Brennan during that interview process. He wanted the Oregon State job, and then he didn't get it. And then Arizona grabbed him after Jed Fish left. And so Brennan would have been the hire. And I kind of think, like, the smarter move for Scott Barnes now appears that maybe he should have hired Brennan as the head coach. He had head coaching experience at San Jose State. He had some proof of performance. And then you make Brennan take Trent Bray as the D coordinator. But, you know, I'm sure Bray stuck around and didn't go with Jonathan Smith to Michigan State because he thought, oh, I might be the head coach here. And so he didn't get on the plane with Jonathan. Let's go to the phone lines. Roy in Portland. Roy, what do you make of it all?
Well, hey, how you doing, John?
Doing well.
First of all, I have to say that we are back. The Bulldogs are back, man. I kind of downed it a little bit, man, but I was like, man, they finally played like the Bulldogs on Saturday, man. So we back at the top of the college football. We're going to win the SEC. Nobody is beating us in the SEC. Texas? Who, Alabama? We get ready to show them. And nobody. We still the kings of the SEC. Nobody is beating us. As far as Oregon, John, I got to step back a little bit, man. I might have been too early with that prediction last week.
Wait a minute, Roy. Wait a minute, Roy. Time out for me. I got two left. You said last week, Georgia, not good, not our year. It's Oregon's year. They're going to win it all. Are you telling me you're walking that all back now?
I have to walk it back, John. What I saw from Northwestern, man, if Georgia played Oregon on Saturday, I didn't know Georgia was capable of that to this Saturday. I thought it was going to be a bad season, but I saw Oregon getting pushed around in the trenches, man. I know y'all saying want to keep it vanilla. That's not what I saw. I saw them getting pushed around. I saw them running the ball, and I kind of just saw a blueprint for the rest of the teams. If you can keep Oregon's offense off the field, you got a chance in winning.
Yeah.
I think Northwestern might have discovered some. But as far as UCLA, John, and Oregon State, man, listen, they don't have any money. Deshaun Foster is who they could afford.
Yeah.
And plus, it was late in the hiring process. Chip Kelly messed up the whole program. He wasn't recruiting people. You know, they couldn't find anybody. It was late. They don't have the money, so they got what they could afford. Same thing with Oregon State. They can't. If Oregon State can go out and get a $10 million coach, I'm sure they would. But they can't afford that. They can only get what they can afford. And when you have teams like an Oregon State, and this is what made Washington State so good over the years, you can't have a defensive-minded coach as your head coach. You have to have a gimmick. When you like a school like a Washington State or Oregon State, schools that are like that, they survive off of having some type of offensive gimmick. Whether it was Mike Leach at Washington State, before him you had the Mike Price, you had Nick Raiola, or whatever you had him. I believe you have to have an offensive-minded coach. Same thing with UCLA. You have to have a spread type of coach that will come in there. I think Sean Lewis may be a great candidate for UCLA or Oregon State. But you have to have you can't have a defensive-minded coach when you're at a school like that. I remember when Purdue used to suck. Yep. Okay? There was a laughing stock of the Big Ten. Then Joe Tiller came in there with an offense that it took a couple years for the Big Ten to catch up on.
Yep.
And he won with lesser talent. And when you have lesser talent in your program and not a lot of money, you cannot have, I don't know what it is, you cannot have a defensive-minded head coach. That's not going to work for you. You need an offensive-minded head coach, somebody with a type of, like I said, some type of gimmick or some type of spread option offense that will keep you in the game. And that's the only way an Oregon State and a UCLA is going to survive, because they don't have the money. UCLA, I don't know what they're going to do. I never thought UCLA should go – the Big Ten should have took UCLA. They should have just took USC, Washington, and Oregon. UCLA does nothing for the Big Ten. They don't invest in the program. Rick Neuheisel was on the show talking about they didn't invest when he was there. They never invested in the program.
No, they didn't. No, Roy, thank you for that. They did not invest. And, in fact, UCLA would have been infinitely better off. There's some karma here. Infinitely better off staying in the Pac-12, not following USC, and saying, we're going to stay right here in the Pac-12, but, hey, we want $50 million a year in media rights distributions. They could have got a lopsided distribution. They would have had an inherent advantage against their own conference members. They could have played at the top of the Pac-12 with whoever else stayed in the conference, and they would have been infinitely better off, because I don't think Utah leaves. I don't think the Arizona schools leave. I actually don't think Oregon and Washington leave. I think it would have just been USC going out the door, and I think that the Pac-12 could have lived to play another day. There may be some karma in it now, because they don't look competitive. I do expect them to go after Jonathan Smith. I expect Will Stein, the offensive coordinator at Oregon, to be a candidate. I think they're going something like that, offensive-minded. And by the way, I covered those Joe Tiller teams. Drew Brees was at quarterback. They had Roosevelt Colvin on defense. They were not bad, but they were a lot of fun running that spread. And Drew Brees, obviously, headed to the Hall of Fame later in his career, was the right guy. I saw him as a freshman running that offense. It was fantastic to watch. We're going to get a UCLA perspective from Mark Shipper, who's Fifth Down College Football. That's his website. We'll talk to him coming up. Also, Sean Lewis, he is the head coach at San Diego State. They've got Cal this weekend. They're preparing for an undefeated Cal Bears team. We'll talk to Sean Lewis in the 4 o'clock hour.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Chip Kelly was one game over 500 in his tenure at UCLA. He did not. He and Martin Jarman, the AD there, did not get along. They did not see eye to eye. Chip didn't like Martin. I don't know if Martin liked Chip. There was a disconnect with those two guys. And I think that did play a role in how Chip Kelly exited at UCLA. I remember being in touch with both of those guys around that time. Was not surprised that that sort of soured, given what they were both saying about each other. The replacement for Chip Kelly, Deshaun Foster, did not fare well. He has been relieved of his duties just 3 games into this season. Here to talk about it, friend of this show, Mark Shipper, Fifth Down College Football, at Fifth Down CFB on Twitter, and a UCLA guy. What do people get wrong about the UCLA narrative, Mark, as they talk about UCLA football?
Well, I think they get it wrong historically in terms of UCLA's place in this sport over a much longer period of time. UCLA is historically a top 15 program in the sport, though if you'd watched them over the last 2 decades, you wouldn't believe that. You know, I think their all-time AP ranking has slipped to like the 17th most ranked team all time. They were down at around 12 at one point. You know, I think people don't understand how much UCLA cared about football at one point and what a sort of devastating situation this is to most UCLA alumni and fans. And that shows up at the Rose Bowl with it being empty and the perceived lack of enthusiasm. And it's really been institutional mismanagement of the program. And there's an opportunity here now, finally, after a long time, to maybe start reversing some of these things that have tanked UCLA. It's been policies. It's not the school. It's not the program. It's not the potential. It's the school has done it to itself.
Let me ask you, you know, you kind of saw this coming. I saw some of your tweets Friday and into Saturday night, and you know, it seemed as though you knew that UCLA was making a change. What can you share with us about kind of the thinking that impacted Martin Jarman and the athletic department's decision?
Yeah, it was the complete and obvious lack of preparation to be on that field and competing against, I mean, forget about peer schools. Utah was a peer school, and they blasted UCLA. But then UCLA got beat by 2 schools that they really, if times are right and the program's running, they should never lose to. And the home loss against New Mexico obviously was probably a bottoming out point for the program that nobody thought they would have hit, a home beatdown by a bottom-dwelling Mountain West school. And they looked so bad doing it. They couldn't tackle. You know, they can't move the ball. They make mistakes. They're penalized all over the place. And when Deshaun Foster came in, you know, his primary platform was his DRE, discipline, respect, enthusiasm. The team had no discipline. So I think the thing was, don't wait to do something later that needs to be done now. And if we make this move now, there's going to be a lot of opportunity to get ducks in a row, pardon the pun, on the out in Oregon out there, and prepare to make a quality offer to the next coach and let them know resources are going to be available to them to compete in the Big Ten. And then being in the Big Ten added a level of urgency to this, because this is no longer hiding out on Pac-12 after dark. You're in the Big Ten. You're going to get a lot of showcase games, and UCLA just can't go out and humiliate itself like that.
The news conference yesterday, Martin Jarman, you know, did not own it. You know, a lot of ADs will say, hey, this is my decision. He didn't. He said there were a lot of stakeholders. There were a lot of people involved in the decision to extend Chip Kelly and then promote Deshaun Foster to head coach. He did talk about a committee that's going to be formed. I hate this idea. I don't like committees, meetings about meetings about meetings. But sounds like they're looking for a hire that the donors and the stakeholders, Troy Aikman, the Wasserman family, are going to be on board with. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, let's say that Martin Jarmond is exactly accurate in that, and that he's not the one making the decisions, and there are a lot of stakeholders. Well, what that means is you have an athletic director who's not in control of his department, who doesn't command respect, and whose decisions aren't trusted and are not followed through with belief from the people who matter. So if Jarmond wants to do that, I don't know if he thinks that makes it look better for him or what, but it does not. It makes it look even worse. So committees are tough. I agree with you. And particularly the more voices you get in that room, and quality voices, the more difficult it can be to get everybody on the same page. So I would actually say that with this long runway they have to do this, I would not be surprised to find out behind the scenes there's some pushing out of leadership at the top and some bringing in of a much smaller group of people who know what they want to do. I don't think it'll end up being a large committee by the time this choice is made.
I look at Jonathan Smith. I think if the timing were a little different, he might have had that job at UCLA when Deshaun Foster got it. I look at a guy like Will Stein, Oregon offensive coordinator. Am I hunting in the right area, in the right neighborhood?
Yeah, I think so. You know, but here's the thing. I look at a program like Indiana, who hired Kurt Cignetti, and this is not talking about UCLA going for Cignetti. This is using this as an example of an established head coach, like Cignetti said when he was hired, "Look me up, I win." I think right now UCLA probably wants to bring in a proven winner and someone who can assemble a program and a staff quickly, and with the resources he needs, and can start winning overnight. Whether or not this guy might even be later stages in his career, and you're talking about a 10-year run and not a 15 or 20-year run, whatever it is, getting momentum back in the program, winning games on TV, reminding people that it's a winning tradition in Westwood, playing in bigger bowl games, et cetera, and going from there. The only issue you have with hiring coordinators and people who, even below coordinator level, you know, the Dan Lannings of the world are the rarities. It's very rare to bring in a guy like that with his experience level and have him hit the ground running so fast like that. With coordinators and the other guys, it can take them some time to get going, but that's not necessarily the case. There are very talented guys out there who are absolutely ready for their opportunity. So I think they're probably looking established guy first, and then maybe coordinator who's ready to pop next.
We're talking to Mark Shipper, Fifth Down College Football. The narrative that UCLA is just a basketball school and should focus on basketball, and anything they do on football is extra. It flies in the face of kind of the conventional thinking where 80% of your media rights revenue is coming from football and all that stuff. Can UCLA afford to have a mediocre football team?
No. No, it's a losing model, and UCLA had known that forever. It's only been a recent thing where they've really forgotten it. And particularly with the size of their athletic department and the way they want to compete in all sports, you know, as bad as UCLA football is, that UCLA went into the Big Ten last year and won more conference championships than any other school. So they started out doing in the Big Ten what they do everywhere, which is win championships. But the football program leads the charge. So no, it absolutely cannot be mediocre. It's the most forward-facing sport, and it's the massive revenue generator. Even a great basketball program cannot compete with the revenue generated by football. So UCLA needs to reorient towards the classical college system, which, like I said, they understood. They built their school competing in football. That was the priority for UCLA for many years. They knew football came first, and then John Wooden showed up and became a great basketball coach. But UCLA was known as a football school. 17 PCC, Pac-8, Pac-10 championships, Sterling Rose Bowl record, all the NFL players, et cetera. UCLA has a winning football tradition, and they have just gotten away from it.
Mark, the timing of this, could it wait? Was there a reason why they wanted to go early? Had the boosters just had enough?
You know, I think it was, I was talking about this earlier. I think it was just so obviously what had to happen. There was no reason to let it run a course. And when you do it this early, you give everybody the opportunity to get organized. You know, and that includes Deshaun Foster, the one thing he was doing well is he was a convincing recruiter. And UCLA needs that. UCLA was starting to line up some pretty good recruiting classes. So the recruits needed to know Foster was going to be gone, and a bunch of them are going to decommit. Maybe all of them are going to decommit. And that's something UCLA knows going in. But again, that's part of wiping the slate clean and resetting and making this plan and executing the plan. So I think it's just to give them maximum time to make a good plan going forward. As Jarmon referenced when he was shirking his responsibility for Chip Kelly, I lost my train of thought there.
Well, I also think the Jarmon conversation has to come back to whether or not he keeps his job. I know they're on the hook for several million dollars to him. Is he the next domino to fall, or do you think UCLA leaves him in place but sort of works around him in some ways?
Yeah, I think they're going to have to work around him for a bit. The thing with Jarmon is one of the reasons there's optimism at UCLA is because they have a new chancellor for the first time, and a chancellor who's made it clear that he understands sports are central to the college experience and that football is central to the athletic department. Between the time that the outgoing chancellor, Gene Block, left and this new chancellor, Julio Frank, came in, UCLA appointed an interim chancellor in Darnell Hunt. And this interim chancellor signed Jarmon to a large extension. And I believe the buyout is in the millions of dollars. It's almost like buying out a coach. So an interim chancellor really overstepped his authority. That contract was left open intentionally for the new chancellor to be able to pick his athletic director, and this interim guy really overstepped his bounds and did that. So I don't know if UCLA wants to look at that contract and see if there's a way to work down the buyout or what it is, but I think Jarmon's probably going to have to be worked around for a little bit. But UCLA needs a new athletic director is the fact of the matter.
The decision makers who are working behind the scenes, I know Troy Aikman has been influential. You also have the Wasserman family. You've got Casey Wasserman and the Wasserman Football Center. And who's making this call?
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't feel comfortable saying, but you're mentioning people, Booster Bucks talk. So I think part of what's going to happen here is they're going to reach out to boosters and the whales and the middle tier, and they're going to find out what would get them excited. Not necessarily who do you want or specifics, but how do we get people back involved in this program? How do we start? They have to start filling up the Rose Bowl. I mean, just flat out, they have to start selling more tickets there. So, and the easiest answer to that is winning football games. And that's kind of why the established head coach is the good route to go, et cetera. But it's going to come down to winning football games, putting people in the seats, and starting to generate revenue again, because UCLA has a revenue generation issue right now.
Well, Jonathan Smith, with an opportunity at Michigan State to go beat USC. Maybe that puts him in play. Mark Shipper, Fifth Down College Football. Thanks, Mark. I appreciate you joining us.
Hi, John. Appreciate you as always.
All right. There he goes from the UCLA perspective. Our big splash is coming up. If I'm UCLA, yes, it's awfully tempting to go with the guy that's going to get a bunch of boosters excited and get people to get money. You want that ideally. But I need somebody who's going to win football games. And I need somebody with proof of performance. So I probably am not going with Will Stein, the Oregon offensive coordinator, because, as much as you're tempted to say, hey, look what Kenny Dillingham did after he left Oregon, Kenny Dillingham had ties to the Phoenix area, to the, Arizona State community. It was like he was coming home. And, so there was a key tie there that would get people excited. Jonathan Smith, Southern California kid. I'm just telling you this. If you're UCLA, if you don't hire Jonathan Smith, someday USC is, and you're going to regret it. Our big splash coming up.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I'm all kinds of fired up about Brian Kelly and the LSU coach. I'll get to that in the 4 o'clock hour. I wouldn't do well. You know how you always say, like, doesn't play well with others? That's Brian Kelly. Doesn't play well with others. Arrogant, obnoxious, bully. I wouldn't do well with him. I wouldn't let him do that in a news conference. I'll tell you what I'm talking about coming up in the 4 o'clock hour. Also, we're going to get a visit from Sean Lewis, San Diego State's head football coach. I am preparing to do my New World Pac-12 tour. I'm going to make a visit down to San Diego. I'm also going to Fort Collins, Colorado. I'm going out to Utah. I'm going to have to go to San Marcos, Texas for the Texas State swing on my tour. But Sean Lewis is coming up at the top of the hour, former Colorado play caller, now the head coach at San Diego State. I got to talk about youth sports parents. I got to talk about you youth sports parents. You are out of control. And I'm not talking about you just getting your kids in a bunch of different sports and taking it all too seriously. You're literally out of control, walking around like you're camping all the time, lugging your gear to the games and setting up. I'm going to get into that in the 4 o'clock hour as well. You need to tone it down. Just show up to the game, bring a chair. Should have a limit on what kind of paraphernalia you can show up to when you go to a youth sports game. You can't be out there if your 9-year-old or your 12-year-old is playing soccer. You cannot be out there looking like you're going out to the middle of the wilderness and camping for 2 weeks. I don't want to see you do that. And I'm watching you do it, and I'm shaking my head. I'm thinking things about you. So all of that coming up at the 4 o'clock hour. We're out early because of Monday night football tonight. We will be carrying, do we know which game we're carrying? Because there's two games going on. It's like a bonanza of football. And by the way, some wild football games over the weekend. The Broncos-Colts. Did you see that game? You see Russell Wilson? He went bananas. A lot of good football over the weekend. Or I should say entertaining football over the weekend. But Steven, do we know which game we're carrying yet here on 750 The Game?
Yeah, the Bucks Texans starts a little earlier than the show. Okay. But we will be carrying it midstream, so
we'll join it in progress.
Yes,
join it in progress. Maybe it'll have a 64-yard field goal to win it all.
We all know the NFL doesn't really get started until the second half anyways.
Yeah, so we'll join it when it gets interesting, just like everybody else. All right, this brings us to our big splash. It is the one thing that you need to know.
This is the one thing you absolutely need to know today.
Look at it. Where? Down there. Must be
the big splash.
Well, Tom Brady's going to suit up, and he's not done playing. You knew this was coming. He's coming out of retirement. Raiders minority owner and 7-time Super Bowl winning quarterback announced today that he's teamed up with Fox Sports and Fanatics for a flag football game. First of its kind, round robin tournament featuring 3 teams of current and former NFL players. This will take place in March at the Kingdom Arena in Saudi Arabia. Yeah, Saudi Arabia. Tom Brady says, it felt like the perfect time for me to hit the field again. Money talks. Tom Brady will get on a plane and go play football, flag football, in Saudi Arabia. Saquon Barkley's going to play. Christian McCaffrey, Myles Garrett, Brock Bowers, Rob Gronkowski. Gronk will be out there. Additional participants to be determined. By the way, the teams are going to be coached by Pete Carroll, Sean Payton, and Kyle Shanahan. Flag football, by the way, will be introduced in the 2028 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. NFL clubs voted in May to permit players to participate. Tom Brady said, quote, "I've always admired the power of flag football." The power of flag football. He'll do anything for a buck, won't he? Like, and I'm not knocking it. Like, you know, go play football if you're Tom Brady. This is a football he can play. He's not going to get hit. Somebody's going to pull his flag. It's perfect. This is perfect for aging quarterbacks. Go play flag football. Go play in the Olympics. Win an Olympic gold medal. I'm not sure. Like, I love flag football for kids, because I think the concepts, the passing game concepts, the 7-on-7, girls flag football sanctioned as a sport in the state of Oregon, going to be dynamite. State of Washington, not far behind, going to be dynamite. I love all this as a competitive sport. And I do think for kids who are playing like tackle football, good for you. That's good. I'm not knocking it. But I am saying, like, there are just some concepts of flag football that I think are helpful in the passing game in particular, and that are going to be beneficial for a lot of kids in the state of Oregon to go play. That said, I am also looking at the Olympics, and I'm going, it's going to be very weird to see teams from, like, Korea, Iran, and Saudi Arabia trying to suit up and play against Saquon Barkley and Tom Brady or whoever's going to play on the Olympic team. Is Patrick Mahomes going to be the quarterback? I don't know. It's going to be weird to see that. And I'm sure the Soviet Union of, like, the 1970s and 1980s relates to this as, you know, they watched, like, United States try to put together a hockey team that could skate on the ice against their 30-year-old professionals who were out there winning gold after gold after gold. And we caught them, didn't we, eventually? I am curious how long it will take the rest of the world to get competitive against the United States in a sport that really is as much about mom, baseball, and apple pie. It's the American sport, football. Curious to see how long before we get challenged at all in this sport.
But, John, isn't this story more about us going to Saudi Arabia and when our games go in there, including maybe a Super Bowl, something like that?
They're gonna take the whole thing. Saudi Arabia's going to own it all. You see the sovereign wealth funds in Saudi Arabia. They've come into the NBA and come into the NFL. They're buying equity stakes in teams that people don't even know about. And, yes, the minute I say this, somebody's going to be emailing me saying, well, you know, the Saudis own the airlines. They own the automobile industry. I get it. They're pumping their money into the United States, but they're trying to sports wash their human interest record and their human rights record by, you know, lining up with smiling Tom Brady and Christian McCaffrey and Kyle Shanahan. And so, yes, that is part of the story. But it was interesting because I was looking at the Blazers ownership group. Like, their private equity firms are all over these sports teams. Leave it here. Sean Lewis coming up.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
One of the hottest stories in college football, the California Golden Bears. Cal 3-0, riding a three-game win streak. Jaron Chiave Sagapulitelli, their quarterback, JKS, they call him. He has been fantastic, true freshman quarterback. They've got a lot of coaching on the offensive side of the ball that they didn't have before. Justin Wilcox, who's a really good defensive coach, head coach there at Cal, brought in Brian Harsin, brought in Nick Rolovich. Harsin's calling the plays. Rolovich is an offensive consultant. Cal looks much better. They travel this Saturday night to San Diego State. And here's a guest I've been trying to get on for a long time. Sean Lewis, head coach, San Diego State. Formerly the offensive coordinator at Colorado, where he worked with Coach Prime and Shedeur Sanders. Sean Lewis joining us fresh off the practice field. How you doing, Coach?
John, how we doing?
Give us an idea what a bye week is like, or a week off. It's not really a week off, is it, when you're coaching football?
Yeah, not really a week off, John. Pleasure to be on with you. But we're doing good. Obviously, you know, use the bye week to, you know, kind of get back to some of our basic fundamentals and get some advanced prep work on Cal. Staff and myself went out, did some recruiting and everything. So kind of a unique experience for the first time I got to bring my son on the road recruiting with me to a high school game. So that was neat. And one of the advantages of being down here in San Diego County with so much good football that obviously just a drive time from my home for the game that I attended and everything. So was able to do that quickly. And we're back at it here as we get ripping and running, you know, for a really good Cal opponent that's coming in this week.
Yeah, I saw them against Oregon State. The true freshman quarterback looks not like a true freshman. What do you see on tape when you look at him?
Yeah, I mean, mature beyond his years, you can tell. And I'm always just impressed. It seems like the advancement of the quarterback position in particular with the training that these guys are getting at the high school level and with the 7-on-7 work that they're doing, you know, his ability to process, read defenses, work through his progression and get the ball out of his hand on time and on target is really, really impressive.
Let's talk about that, drill down a little bit, because you do see guys who are working with coaches on the side. I know Steve Clarkson does some camps and some others. So what are these guys getting that maybe quarterbacks weren't getting before?
You know, I think it's probably a advanced knowledge of, you know, coverages, concepts, how to read them, how to match and marry their footwork so that they're throwing in rhythm. And then I think just the overall, you know, body sequencing and mechanics of the throwing motion are more refined because of the special technical aspect of the private coaches. If you're married with the right guy, and you're getting the proper coaching, you know, there's obviously a benefit to that, where if you can have your sequencing down, if you can have your footwork and your arm action in the proper arm slot repeatedly, and you're making, you know, higher quality throws quicker and at a younger age, then you get more high quality reps that get accumulated faster, I think, which then allow you to play at a higher level, you know, sooner when you reach the college game.
This is an unprecedented time, and I think it's in a particularly tough time for coaches who are taking over programs. You just did that. You've been through that. I think Trent Bray at Oregon State's going through it. Washington State's going through it. We watched Brett Brennan at Arizona, Jed Fish at Washington, Kalen DeBoer at Alabama. Can you speak to that a little bit? Like, what, how different it is right now? Because I don't think there's a blueprint for, you know, hey, you come in, you take over a program. There's just, it's a moving target now. There are new challenges. What has that been like?
Yeah, it's a unique challenge. And you know what you need to get done. However, I think at each one of those institutions that you just mentioned in San Diego State, like how you get those things done is probably wildly different, right? Like based off the university that you're at, based off the conference that you're in, you know, there's different layers to the problem solving process that you have to go through, even though you know, like, all right, this is the end result that needs to happen. Like I got to get this kid out of the portal, get him admitted, but how does that happen at my university? Who are the people that are actually going to make that happen, right? And so even though how you solve each problem that may look different at each place, I think still ultimately, John, it comes down to how you care for your people and how you serve your people and ultimately, right, like pour into each individual person, because all of us, no matter what scheme we're running, what conference we're doing it in, or how we're operating, right? Like we're still in the business of caring for young men. And if you care for the young person, you help them grow, you help them mature, they're comfortable, they're confident within the framework of your program that you're building, then the execution and the results that we're all hoping for and that we're all chasing for, then that comes. You know, I think if we get that backwards and it becomes too transactional, then it's not sustainable, right? And we want to build something that is consistently, you know, sustainable over time and not just a flash in the pan, one and done deal, but that year in and year out, right here at San Diego State, we're competing at a high level and we're doing that consistently and not just, you know, seeing occasional greatness every now and again.
The new world Pac-12 will start in a year, but kids are focused on, you know, what can I do this year? Are you able to yet talk to recruits and do you see some traction there, or how receptive are they to the idea of this, what this new conference will be, or is that even on their radar right now?
Yeah, I mean, for the high school kids in particular, it's definitely top of mind, right? And we've talked a ton about it. I mean, shoot, going all the way back to when we were hosting, you know, unofficial visits in the wintertime and through spring ball. And then when we got to official visit season, it's been instrumental for us to speak to how we're going to the Pac-12, how this class, which right now of all the members that are going to the Pac-12 that we have committed to us, is the number one, you know, ranked class of all those institutions. And we got to do a great job getting all of them across the finish line and getting them all signed. But it was a big piece of the conversation. It was a big piece of the sell with the stage and, you know, the spotlight that's going to be on us, right? And how they're the class that's going to usher us into the Pac-12. And I think that excited a lot of people. And then being able to do that great work with great people here in San Diego has really positioned us in a good spot.
Sean Lewis with us, San Diego State head coach. You've worked a number of places. You know, I have a lot of listeners and readers who kind of want to know what your experience at Colorado was like in the reality television world of college football. And how was that to be on the inside of what was happening with Coach Prime and Shador? And you were working directly with Shador.
Yeah, tremendous opportunity and led me here to San Diego State. You know, so thankful for that. Thankful for the opportunity. Was amazing to work with generational talents and obviously a legendary, you know, individual in Coach Sanders. And because of all that, you know, very, very fortunate to have this opportunity to be speaking with you as the head coach at San Diego State University.
Can you take things like I've worked at six different newspapers, and I think I learned things everywhere, and I wouldn't take all of what I learned from any of those places. But can you take things from your different stops? Like when you go to talk to people about who you are now as the coach at San Diego State, how much do you look back and go, okay, I took this from this experience, that from that experience? You're kind of this amalgam of where you've been.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are truly green and growing and, you know, have a learner's mindset, I think all of us do that, right? So from your six different newspapers, me, whether it was a coaching at the high school level, coaching at Division II level, coaching at the FCS level, ACC, the MAC, the Big 12, and now obviously the Mountain West, like not only each spot taught me something, but again, I go back to the people. I mean, I've been very fortunate to where guys have been a part of staffs or my staff, right, to where, I mean, the outside linebacker coach for the Rams was on my staff at Kent State, Joe Coniglio. The secondary coach for the Falcons and Justin Hood was on my staff at Kent State. The offensive coordinator for the Texans, we worked together as first full-time coaches at Eastern Illinois, right? So you learn from them. You learn from their approaches. You take the things that you feel can enhance your own skills, right? And, again, when you're around elite people, it kind of makes you – you know, refine your process, right? And you have to elevate when you're around those people and in those places as well, right? So I would like to think and truly believe that I'm not the same coach that I am today than I was, you know, 5 years ago, a decade ago, because of the places and the people that I've been at or that I've been around.
You played quarterback in high school. If we go back to Harold Richards High School in Oaklawn, Illinois, you were the school's career passing leader, 39 touchdown passes in three seasons. Little bit of a dual threat guy, 900 yards on the ground, 15 touchdowns. Could Sean Lewis, the player, have played for Sean Lewis, the coach?
I probably would have recruited him as a big athlete the way that Coach Alvarez recruited me as a big athlete.
Right.
And at the end of the day, probably would have found a spot. I don't know if it would have been in the quarterback room when all was said and done, but I would like to think that, you know, younger I really enjoyed the game and would have found a way on the field the way that I did for the Badgers back in the day.
Yeah, and then correct me if I'm wrong. So you graduate at Wisconsin, and then do you go to work as a gym trainer, like a personal trainer, or what were you doing?
Yeah, I mean, right, like figuring it out the way that we all are, John, the way that I still am trying to figure it out, right? Like,
right.
I think one thing that all of us are doing as the world continues to evolve, right? You're just trying to, hey, figure it out and make it work for your loved ones and for yourself. So, yeah, when I graduated, right, it was always like, hey, go get a degree. Like, all right, cool. Got the degree. Now what? It's like, oh, well, go get a job. You got bills to pay. So, all right, well, let's figure that out. And, yeah, had a couple odd jobs there early on. One was a personal trainer, in the Chicagoland area, was an in-school suspension supervisor, sold some office supplies, you know, tended some bar, did a lot of different things. And then, you know, fell in love with obviously coaching and helping people change in their lives. And probably that personal training gig was kind of the first taste of that, right? Like helping people, you know, make some changes, you know, develop some good habits, and you help them, you know, through that process. And it's kind of cool to share your knowledge and help some people grow in that regard. And that's really all we're trying to do as coaches at the end of the day.
I got to think you look at the office in Dunder Mifflin and think, like, you know, that you lived a little bit of that life. Selling office supplies.
Yeah, a little bit. Some reams of paper and some toner. I've forgotten quite a bit about that. But at one point in time, I knew way more than I needed to know.
All right. You've got Cal. They've got Brian Harsin and Nick Rolovich on that offensive side. Are you seeing their influence on Cal's offensive scheme now that you had a chance to get a bigger sample size? I know Oregon State was, you know, blind to it when they played them in week one. But you know, now you've got some tape.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, right? Like you kind of do some of your advanced prep in the off season, right? We're all early on, week one, week two, you're chasing some ghosts. But, you know, by the time you get to this point where you have a three-game sample size, you can see it coming together. And, yeah, there's a wealth of offensive knowledge and wisdom that they have and how they're formulating the plans. You can tell they're doing a really good job of sharing ideas. And most importantly, I mean, all the information and all the knowledge that Coach Harsin and Coach Rolovich have, they're doing an excellent job of giving it to JKS, right? And he's going out and he's applying, he's operating it, and he's doing it at a really, really high level. So, you know, we got to have an elite week of preparation here because they all have all kinds of momentum that they have earned. Obviously, riding a three-game winning streak, there's all kinds of belief. And we got to do a great job, obviously, with our prep and starting fast here on Saturday night.
All right, Coach, thanks for doing this. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, John, absolutely.
There he goes, Sean Lewis. He is the coach at San Diego State. They have Cal this weekend in a big big matchup. Obviously, Cal riding high, as he mentioned there, and in great position. They do not play Miami. They do not play Clemson. They do not play Florida State. This is the 7:30 game on Saturday night. Cal is at San Diego State. Big one for the Aztecs. Big one for Sean Lewis, who's looking for some traction. He is like Trent Bray, like Brent Brennan, like Kalen DeBoer, like Jed Fish, just trying to get that early traction. And I look back, I think Lewis has coached 14 games at San Diego State, and trying to get his feet underneath him, and then also preparing for entry to the New World Pac-12, right, in 2026. It is a moving target what San Diego State is up against. Any coach who's coming in and having taken over a program that is in transition, and you got the transfer portal, you got NIL, the rules are changing. Can you imagine? I mean, it's hard enough as it is to take over as a coach, but coming in this era, man, it's a lot like parenting, okay? It's a lot like the youth sports scene that we're all trying to navigate. It's wild, right? Like I was thinking about this over the weekend because the 9-year-old had a soccer game. By the way, it was driving rain. Rain going sideways. What happened? Like, it was sunny on like Saturday. It was beautiful. I was working outside a little bit Saturday. I was like, man, it's all sunny and beautiful. And then all of a sudden, here came Sunday morning and it was torrential rain. We're out at 9-year-old soccer. I've got an umbrella. I've got a raincoat. Her sister's wearing a parka. And here we go. Here comes fall in Oregon. This whole youth sports thing is out of control, is it not? I'm not even talking about the industry right now, because the industry itself is an amazing study. Like, you can look around and look at the billions, with a B, billions of dollars that are invested in youth sports, the private lessons, the training, the specialization, the travel. If you have a kid who plays club sports, you know it's like $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 to travel during the season. It's out of control. The cost of the sports itself, the equipment, out of control. But I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about the parents. Parents, I see you. You're like camping at these games. People are setting up tents. They're bringing coolers. They're bringing lawn chairs. They're bringing sleeping bags and rolling them out on the ground. You've got moms who are walking around with water flasks filled with booze, a little bit of wine for your Sunday. Like, people are camping. Like, I'm waiting for at one of these youth soccer games for people to suddenly start roasting marshmallows and weenies and throwing axes and setting up hammocks on the side of the field. You literally are bringing campers to the events. I had my older daughter, when she played volleyball, one of the families had a Winnebago. They would bring that Winnebago to the gym. They park it in the parking lot. And, you know, you got like a home away from home to hang out in between the games. That's how long these days are. I'm watching these moms at youth sports games who have like these portable seats where they, you know, they basically wear it like a backpack, and then they set it up on the seat, and it's got like, you know, a seat warmer on it. It's battery powered. It's got a, you know, it vibrates so it can give you a massage while you're watching your kid's game. And out at the soccer matches, you literally have these little igloo like structures. Have you seen these things that parents can kind of surround their chair with? They can put a heater inside of it, and you can zip it and unzip it, and that way you have your own little area so you don't have to sit outside. We are out of control is what I am saying. There is a whole nother industry beyond the industry that is focused on sort of the parent experience, the camping experience that accompanies your kid's youth sports game. And look, there's money in this. So there's no secret why you see kind of the evolution of all this stuff. There's absolutely a business that is at play here. The youth sports industry not just a cottage industry. I mean, this is a booming business with kids playing year-round basketball and lacrosse and soccer and baseball. I can remember the baseball season. My baseball season as a kid was like 18 or 20 games, and then was there an all-star season or not? Like, you had that question. These kids are playing like fall league and winter league and then the regular season. And, you know, they're playing like 162-game schedule by the time they're done with it. And have you seen the cost of the bats? I went into Dick's Sporting Goods and I picked up a couple of the bats on the bat rack, and literally they've got like the sensors on them so you can't walk outside the store with it because they know these bats are like $400 bats. It is out of control. All of it is out of control. But parents, you are the guiltiest of all parties. You are literally camping at these youth soccer games. I am watching you, and you're bringing your wagons. You're bringing your lawn chairs. You're setting up your tents. I don't think we're that far off from somebody setting up like a Traeger barbecue and doing some ribs while the 9-year-olds play soccer. Can you imagine? All right. We've got much more show ahead. We're going to lead you right into the NFL game here. Games, I guess, on Monday Night Football times two on this great Monday. I appreciate everybody who's listening. Good interview with Sean Lewis. You could tell a little bit he was reluctant to talk about his time with Coach Prime and Shador. He's just not going to go there, not going to touch it. Kind of reiterated, I am the coach at San Diego State University. That's his way of like not going full Brian Kelly on me, but just reminding me, hey, I want to talk about my program, my time here. It's fine. I'm still going to ask the question because I think it was probably a reality television show that he could not get away from fast enough. You notice in that first season in Colorado, Coach Prime had his offensive coordinator, Sean Lewis, and his defensive coordinator, Charles Kelly, both ran for the hills at the end of the season. Both of them were like, thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm on to other things. And Lewis, to his credit, he ends up at San Diego State, where J.D. Wicker, the athletic director there, obviously saw something in him, is buying into him full throttle. And, you know, but he's got to get some traction. He's 4-10 in 14 games, and here comes Cal on Saturday night. All right, leave it here. You got the bald-faced truth statewide. I appreciate those of you out there who make this radio show part of your day. I appreciate those of you who read me at johnconzano.com. The Monday mailbag included a cameo appearance from Mark Cuban. I emailed Mark Cuban. I have over the years. I've stayed in touch with him. But I emailed Mark Cuban and asked him what he thought of Tom Dundon, the Blazers' newest owner. Cuban gave me his answer. It's in the Monday mailbag. Leave it here. You got the BFT.
Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I am not afraid to ask the hard question. I'm not afraid to address the elephant in the room. And in fact, I pride myself when I do some of these interviews on the show, like, hey, you know, I have to ask the question. I'm not going to shy away from it. I know our producers, it sometimes creates problems because sometimes we try to get guests on the show and the guest is maybe facing an issue that is controversial and they don't want to talk about it. I do not make deals. I do not agree to do interviews with, oh, I'm not going to ask about this or I'm not going to ask about that. I can remember Kenny Dillingham, people may remember last season, the Arizona State coach. He had kind of a hiccup in the early part of the season where his kicker had missed a bunch of kicks, and he, in one of the post-game news conferences, said, hey, I want to open up an open tryout on campus. We're going to bring a kicker in. We're going to try to find somebody who can kick field goals. And it caused a little bit of a storm, and Dillingham eventually had to apologize because he had called out the kicker, embarrassed the kicker. He's still learning to be a head coach. He's youngest coach in college football, and I can remember Dillingham not wanting to talk about it. Well, Arizona State's media relations person reached out to me because Dillingham was supposed to come on the show and said, hey, can you not ask him about the kicker? And I was like, what are you talking about? Not asking about the kicker in that comment. Like, it wasn't going to be the focus of my interview, but I bristle when somebody tells me, some PR person tries to tell me how to do my job. And I bristle at like the idea that like, I'm not, okay, you're telling me what to what? Not ask about what? Like, it just rubs me the wrong way. I don't appreciate that, and I don't play that game. And so I told the guy, I said, you know, first of all, I don't do any interviews that are contingent upon me not asking something or definitely asking something, or, you know, this is not a PR thing for you. This is not, you know, you want to do that interview, go do it on your state sanctioned pregame show or your postgame show. Don't do it here. And so I kind of pushed back against the guy, and he was like, you know, Dillingham, we will end the interview if you don't. I was like, I've known Kenny for a long time, longer than that guy had at the time. And I said, I'm going to ask him the question. He can answer it however he wants, but I'm definitely going to ask Kenny Dillingham, like, hey, what did you learn from that experience? Like singling out a player, embarrassing the kid, you know, kind of airing your dirty laundry in the post-game news conference and then having to walk it back a day later. Like, talk me through that. Like, it's a very human experience. And the guy said, well, if you do that, then Kenny's going to end the interview. And I said, we'll see about that. I reached out to Dillingham before the interview. I said, I'm going to ask you that question. Like, just like to prepare you. I'm going to ask you. I'm not going to not ask you. So just don't think I'm, you know, like I'm not a jerk for asking that question. It's the obvious freaking question. Like, that's the thing everybody wants to know about. Like, so why wouldn't I ask that question? And I asked the question and Dillingham answered it. And it was fine. Didn't need the PR guy in the middle of it. So I'm not afraid to ask the hard question. So I rather appreciate some of the LSU beat reporters and columnists and radio show hosts and TV commentators who show up to the LSU postgame news conference to deal with Brian Kelly on a regular basis. Now, I find Brian Kelly, the LSU head football coach, to be a bully. I think Brian Kelly and I would not get along. I've covered Bobby Knight. I've covered Jerry Tarkanian. I was covering the 49ers when Terrell Owens was there. I covered the Blazers with Rasheed Wallace. I've dealt with some delicate media situations. I covered Barry Bonds during all that Balco, the cream and the clear, all that. So I understand how to deal with a sensitive topic and ask the question that needs to be asked. You don't go out of your way as a media member to be a jerk. You don't grandstand. You don't try to make it about you. But you definitely need to ask the question. And I thought this reporter, after LSU's win over the weekend, asked a very fair question in the news conference. And you can hear it in the reporter's voice. He knows who Brian Kelly is. He knows that Kelly's not going to be happy about having to answer this question in this interview setting. I mean, it's uncomfortable by definition. So because he, you know, you could just tell he knows what he's up against. And yet he asks the question, which I respect. And then Brian Kelly plays the role of bully magnificently. Listen for yourself.
Brian in the back, I know you love these immediate post-game sessions, but what are you seeing with your offense?
Stop. Really? Is that the first question? We won the game 20-10. Try another question. What do you want me to tell you? I just laid it out for you. We played the game to win the game. We played the game to win the game.
All right. How about third down then? What is going on with third down?
It's one game. Last game, we were great on third down. You're looking at this from the wrong perspective. LSU won the football game. Won the game. I don't know what you want from me. What do you want? You want us to win 70-0 against Florida to keep you happy?
No, I think people want to know why you can't run the ball, quite honestly.
We can run the ball. Did you see the last play of the game? That's all you need. You just need one. There's a ridiculous questions. And I'm getting tired of it. That football team just worked their tail off to get an SEC win, and you want to know what's wrong. You know what? You're spoiled. You're spoiled. This team is 17-1 at night. 17-1. Give them some respect. How about that? Give them some respect instead of micro-analyzing every little thing. This is ridiculous. For a group of seasoned reporters, that kind of question is so out of line.
I think this is lamer than lame of Brian Kelly. He's obviously doing something here. Like, he's trying to make his point. Look how great we are. He's playing to the lowest common denominator in the fan base. Hey, we won the game. We coached to win. He's also sending a code red to media members. Don't ask me tough questions, because if you do, I'm going to push back and I'm going to try to make this, I'll make this about you and what a dumb question that was. It's not a dumb question. It is a fair question that this reporter is asking Brian Kelly. It is fair game for the reporter to be like, hey, you know, the offense hasn't performed in this situation or hasn't performed in that situation. What do you say about that? Because it was part of the story of the game. And people who watch LSU football understand, like, you know, they didn't play a perfect game. And Brian Kelly should be prepared, aside from his opening statement and all the fluffy questions. And I've told coaches over the years, I've said to him, look, You got enough people out there that are going to tell you how great you are. Tell your program, oh, your program's so great. It's so wonderful. Everybody's great. You're the greatest ever. And, you know, you should be the coach. You have enough of that butt kissing going on out there. Do you really need a room full of your reporters to turn into an audience of sycophants who are going to sit there and smooch up to you and only throw softball questions at you? And clearly, Brian Kelly in this situation is happy that he won the football game and expecting to get a pat on the back. And I also find him to be unnecessarily combative in situations like this. He's done it multiple times after wins, after losses. I can't decide if the guy is worse to deal with after an LSU win or after an LSU loss, for crying out loud. And that's not a compliment to Brian Kelly. He's difficult. He's bully-like. And I think, you know, he does this sort of ham-handed, backhanded thing where he's like, well, you know, this room full of reporters, you guys are professionals, you know, while he's treating the reporters in a very unprofessional way. I've encountered this before. Brian Kelly did not invent this game. I know what he's doing. It is manipulation 101, and he's trying to manipulate his own media contingency, to, you know, this contingent of media that follows the team. He's trying to manipulate the pool into being like, hey, you guys, don't get out of line. Don't ask me hard questions. Don't criticize my team. How dare you? And he's really talking to the reporter as if he's like some guy in a message board chat room trying to push back and say LSU and Brian Kelly are the greatest thing ever. I have found Brian Kelly to be obnoxious, arrogant, childish, immature, and he's a bully, plain and simple. And this is not his first encounter. It's not the first time he's done it. And I mean, look, I said this off the top, like, I don't think I would get along with him. I think he and I would be, a reality television show in a news conference, because I would not allow him to speak to me like that. And I would not allow, I'd push back against him and I would keep asking the questions. And in fact, what it makes you want to do as a reporter when you cover somebody like this is it makes you, when you are justified, it makes you want to absolutely bring it up and call him on it. It doesn't, that has the opposite effect to me. And I can remember when I went to cover Bobby Knight at Indiana, I walked in that first time. I was young. I was in my late 20s and was looking around, and all these media members, these are guys who had been on the beat like 10, 15, 20 years. They all kind of looked beat down to me. They looked like, you know, they were just kind of beat down and they had fallen in line. It was almost like watching, you know, a platoon in the army, and you kind of see the drill sergeant has got him beat down. And it was Bobby Knight. He had sort of conditioned everybody to not ask the tough question, to not challenge him, to not call him on his BS. And it was pretty effective. And I think Brian Kelly knows exactly what he is doing. And the thing that'll kill him is when he doesn't win football games, because those media members, I can tell you right now, they are not fond of him. They tolerate him. I want you to leave it here. The 5 at 5 still ahead, top of the hour. You got the BFT.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Brian Kelly, the LSU coach, has apologized. Good. Should apologize. It was a jackass in that news conference. Some of these people are worse to deal with when they win versus when they lose. You know, there's, oh, I told you we're the greatest. I told you so. It won't be the last time for him. Brian Kelly, LSU coach, apologizing to the reporter. We're going to play some Punch It audio. Coming up top of the hour, Steven's going to give the 5 at 5, and then we're going right into NFL football. It was a big NFL weekend. We have a lot to talk about. Let's do this.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio,
presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Trent Bray, Oregon State football coach, had a bad showing. Beavers got blasted at Texas Tech. Trent Bray says the effort was a step backwards.
Yeah, there were some particular plays that I'd mentioned, the third and extra longs, the two that really broke our back in the game. They threw the ball behind the line of scrimmage and got not only a first down, but a touchdown. And we had guys that weren't running to the ball that could have been a factor and got the guy on the ground. So that was the biggest thing that we talked about is you don't know when you're going to be the impact on the play. You have no idea. And so you got to chase the ball every single play like you're going to be the factor in our success on that play. And so, again, continuing to drill that into these guys' heads. And because it wasn't something we'd seen, you know, Fresno, we took a huge step forward and how the physicality, the effort, and we kind of took a step back, which wasn't good to see.
I didn't like the effort either at Oregon State. But I think this is a, like, this is this effort thing. I don't know why we're talking about it. Why are we talking about this after three games? Why are we talking about an effort issue at Oregon State? Why are we talking about their inability to snap the ball at Oregon State?
You know what it reminds me of, John? It reminds me of the Trailblazers the last couple of years when they sucked really bad. We're like, man, well, at least they played hard. Like, that was the thing we looked at. Like, are they actually playing hard? That's where we're at with Beaver right now. Like, are they giving effort? Do they care? And if they are, we're congratulating them for it. It's just not a good, you know, sense of time for them right now.
It's just the bar is so low. I happen to be watching an eighth grade football game over the weekend. I stopped by. There was an eighth grade football game going on. Play in particular, I was watching, you know, and I'm just kind of casually watching this game. This running back is running down the field, and he fumbles the ball. And this kid who was trailing the play, and he's on his team, but hustling downfield to maybe help with a block, ends up falling on the loose fumble. And I thought to myself, gosh, what a hustle play by a young player. This is something that is happening in an eighth grade football game. Why are we talking about this with college players? Effort? Effort? Nick Costas going off on Travis Kelce here. Travis Kelce was among multiple Chiefs players who wore T-shirts in support of suspended wide receiver Rashee Rice, basically saying, free four. Costas didn't like it.
Rashee Rice seems like, I don't know him, seems like a decent young man who knows that he screwed up and took responsibility for it immediately. Took his suspension like a man, and has kind of disappeared into the shadows for now. And it seems like he's handled all of this really well. Rashee Rice, free four. Rashee Rice is not like on the trade block for the Chiefs. It's not like a Micah Parsons situation. It's not like the Chiefs aren't paying him. It's not like he's been like taken captive by the Russian government. Free four. Like he's in North Korea. Free four. He was involved, like, was drag racing in a multi-car accident that left multiple people injured. Free four. Are you kidding? Does anyone think that this is ridiculous? But then you have Travis Kelce wearing it. Yeah, I need to be more I gotta be focused on the game. But let me wear the shirt saying, free my teammate who almost got people killed drag racing in the offseason last year. Free him. Like, this is some, like, miscarriage of justice that Rashee Rice is suspended. What an absolute joke and a smack in the face of anyone whose life was adversely affected by this. This guy's clueless. Heads up his rear end.
You know, the funny thing that I come away with from this story, it's a little different. You know, I get it. You've got multiple Kansas City Chiefs players who are showing support for their teammate, right? But not every Kansas City Chiefs player was wearing that T-shirt. Like, more were not wearing it than decided to wear for it. Like, it's just a handful of members who decided that they were going to make this statement. I think it's an interesting statement about, like, the vocal minority in any subset in society. Like, keep in mind, like, the people who are wearing those T-shirts get the attention, but everybody else who said, basically, I'm not wearing that shirt, doesn't get the vote, right? Doesn't get to be to have themselves be counted. Dante Moore, Oregon quarterback. They've got Penn State coming up. They've got Oregon State this week. He was asked, he was dragged onto the Fox Big Noon set after Oregon's win over Northwestern. I thought it was interesting. They tried to get him to do the Heisman pose. He wouldn't do it. Urban Meyer asked him this question. How do you maintain focus? You've got Oregon State, then Penn State. How do you keep your guys focused? Here's Dante.
We just, you know, we have a lot of games ahead, but I feel like this team, our mindset is 1-0 every week. We're, you know, worrying about that opponent during the weekend. You know, today we're going to fly back home. Tomorrow's going to be a recovery day. And then Monday when we hit the ground, we're going to be straight focused on Oregon State. You know, it's a rivalry game, but every time we take the field, it's us versus us.
It's us versus us. I like that he did not stand up and strike the Heisman pose. I saw Travis Hunter do exactly the opposite last year. He ends up winning the Heisman. I get it. It's all about marketing. It's all about hype. You can help yourself in this setting. But I kind of like that the Oregon quarterback is following more in the mold of a Bo Nix and a Dylan Gabriel, being a little more understated, having the eye on the prize, so to speak. I think it becomes very easy in today's college football to get your eye off the ball. Dante Moore seemingly has his eye on the ball. Dan Orlovsky talking about Joe Burrow. Burrow out 3 months with a grade 3 turf toe. Orlovsky says it's a lesson for everybody.
Because it feels like Joe Burrow is trending towards becoming this generation's Andrew Luck in a way. So we are calling the Raiders-Chargers game. And in talks with Coach Harbaugh yesterday, the thing that stood out was when he said to us, all I think about is I have to protect Justin Herbert. That's all I think about. Because if I protect Justin Herbert, we can go to the Super Bowl and win it. And the Bengals have to look at that and go, we haven't committed to doing that organizationally. We haven't. You just heard Field say it. If I'm a team in the NFL, I'm paying attention to it and going, I am learning from that because I don't want my young player and my quarterback to have that similar experience.
Yeah, but nobody thinks it's going to be them. Nobody thinks their young quarterback's going to have that experience. Truth is, the league throws these young quarterbacks to the dogs and then sees what happens. Jalen Hurts says that the Eagles win over the Chiefs shows who they are. Hurts only had 101 passing yards. Is that who they are?
Games like this kind of show you who you are and where you are with that. We knew we were going to come into the game and the flow of it would kind of go. They would do some things on defense. They would do some things on offense, and then we would do some things on our side of the ball. But it was about responding, and I'm happy with how we responded in those key moments.
They responded. They got the W. Meanwhile, a wild NFL game. Dallas 40, New York Giants 37. Russell Wilson, 450 yards, 3 touchdowns for the Giants. Dak Prescott, 361 passing yards for the Cowboys. The story really was Brandon Aubrey, 64 yards to tie the game. Here's how it sounded.
Aubrey, does he have enough? On the way, it is good! That's why they trusted him. Wow. Never a doubt. On to overtime.
Wow. The kickers are getting good, aren't they? 64 yards. Meanwhile, Georgia Tech hit a 55-yarder to beat Clemson. Here's how that sounded.
On this from 55. The snap is off. It is on the way. It's got the distance.
There it is. Georgia Tech, 55-yard game winner, Clemson. By the way, Georgia Tech had lost 9 straight times to Clemson. That was a catharsis. UCLA has fired Deshaun Foster. Andy Staples says, man, is that a tough job. UCLA football.
UCLA is going to have to show people that it cares about football. Of all the schools that changed conferences in the last few years, UCLA seems the least interested in trying to make a splash in its new conference. You know, Oklahoma was devastated by being terrible in their first year in the SEC, so much so that Brent Venables opened this season on the hot seat. UCLA, when Chip Kelly left, had a fairly uninspired search. They were looking to hire on the cheap. They end up hiring Deshaun Foster, who's a loyal alum, but probably was not ready for that job. And so you go to the situation where you need to find somebody who can really outpunch their weight, because UCLA doesn't have the resources that most of the Big Ten schools that compete have. UCLA is paying $10 million a year in calimony to Cal. This is a bad situation. This is a tough job.
It is a tough job, and the track record at UCLA doesn't bode well. Deshaun Foster had a win percentage of that, you know, was like 333. Chip Kelly was at 507. He was 35-34, 6.5 seasons. Jim Mora before Chip Kelly, 46-30. Rick Neuheisel before that, 21-29. Carl Durrell before that, 35-27. Bob Toledo, 49-32. You have to go back to Terry Donahue to find a coach who is significantly over a 60% win percentage.
You talked about this job, John, like Jonathan Smith, it's a better job than Michigan State. Is it a better job than Michigan State? Like, you can't win at this school. It's been proved. You just proved right there. They haven't won since the 90s at UCLA. Michigan State made a college football playoff when there was four seeds. And then you look at, like, Will Stein. Like, why would you go and choose that job as a job when you could have probably a much better job? To me, it seems like if I'm a coach, I am avoiding UCLA at all costs, and I'm going to stick it out for another year as a coordinator or another year at my own school before I figure that out.
I've been to East Lansing, Michigan. I think that is I'd rather live in L.A. than East Lansing. So Jonathan Smith, a Southern California kid, grew up as a USC fan. I think his dream job is being at USC, but I think UCLA would be like the 1B for him. I also think Jonathan Smith's a guy, if you look at his track record, places he's coached, Oregon State included, he's gone some places that historically haven't had a lot of success, and he's had better success, right? So I think what he was building at Oregon State was special, and I think very unique to watch him have success there. And, you know, team that, you know, I go back to his last season. They were playing Washington on a pouring rain night late in the season. They lose 22-20 to the Huskies. They were the number 10 team in the country at the time, Stephen. Like, he did that at Oregon State. I do think he is the kind of guy that could go to UCLA and win. I also think he needs to hear some things from UCLA before he should think about doing it. But Michigan State, I don't think it's a great job in the Big Ten. I think it's the equivalent of Oregon State in the old world Pac-12. It, you know, you're not in the upper echelon. You're in that second tier of teams. You can look really good and probably get a lot of love winning 9 games. If you win 9 games in a year, you're going to look like you're a genius. But I do think Jonathan Smith's one of those guys. You bring up a great point with Will Stein. If Oregon does what I think it's going to do this season and makes the playoff, Will Stein might have better jobs available to him. And I don't necessarily think UCLA calls to him in the way it would call to Jonathan Smith. But we will see how that unfolds. I think Stein will have his choice of a few different jobs. Awkward exchange here with Trent Bray. He was asked, is he the right coach at Oregon State?
Do you believe you're still the right person to lead this program?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I think for the same reason when I took it over. That's love this place, love this program. I think we got good coaches. We got good players. We got to continue to get better and continue to, you know, get the best out of these guys.
When you look at the fact that you guys are at risk of having lost 10 of your last 11 games over the two seasons, you're talking about effort. There have been, preparedness issues with false starts and the 12-man penalty, and the defense looks like it's taken a step back. How do you reconcile that with what you're talking about with the direction of the program?
Yeah, the penalties are something that's got to get cleaned up. I don't look at what happened on Saturday and judge the whole, you know.
Trent Bray on a warming seat.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
We're going to lead you right into NFL football here on this Monday night. Is it night yet? It is. I guess it's 5 o'clock. We're in the happy hour. It'll be 11 minutes of happiness right here as we do the 5 at 5 and then take you straight into NFL football. Steven is ready with the 5 biggest stories in sports. Let's do it.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
Well, John, it is Civil War week. I think we're forgetting that already. It is the Civil War week. Oregon taking on Oregon State. Right now, the betting line in this game, John, I hope you're sitting down here, 35 points right now. Oregon is favored over Oregon State. That actually ties the largest point spread in the Civil War history, according to my research, from what I found. Oregon has been a 35-point favorite a couple of different times. The last time, I believe, was in 2015. They were 35-point favorites. Now, this line actually opened up at 27.5, quickly jumped up to 35.5.
Yeah.
I still would take Oregon. I don't know how Oregon State keeps this one close. Oregon can name its number against the Beavs. But we are officially in Civil War week. I still just I don't understand why Oregon State wants to play this game. I know it saves money. I know it saves on travel, but just to get your brains beat in, it just doesn't seem like it's worth it to me.
I need a bigger sample size. I know there's probably a greater disparity right now between these two programs than at any point in history. I think there's a real risk that Oregon State scores maybe 7 or 10 points or less in this game. And so this really does come down to, you know, 45, 55. I don't think Dan Lanning's going to be interested in embarrassing Oregon State. But I think Oregon will score 49 to 56 points pretty easily in this game. Defensively, I don't think Oregon State can stay with the Ducks. And I also think, I'm looking over at the Apple Cup. Somebody asked me today in the Monday mailbag at johnconzano.com, is the Apple Cup or the Civil War going to be a bigger margin of victory? I actually think there's a risk that Jed Fish in Washington try to pour it on in the Apple Cup, given that John Mateer in Washington State beat him last year. And so there is a little bit of a we got to get you back going on. Steven, if I pose that question to you, larger margin of victory in the Civil War or the Apple Cup, what would you say?
I agree. I think it would be Washington State because I think there's more hatred there. It is in Pullman, though, so I think that it has a little bit, deters me a little bit, but I do think Washington has showed the ability to pour it on. Washington State, their performance against North Texas was abysmal as well, you know, losing, what, 59-13, something like that. And now I think at Oregon State, you know, Dan Lanning may not want to put it on him, but he also can't control the snapping issues. If Oregon State can't even snap a punt, I mean, he's going to have to score these points. I think I would take the Washington State game. I think they're both pretty much blowouts, and they can name their number on it.
And here's the other thing, too. Like, Oregon got penalized by the AP Top 25 voters by not covering that spread against Northwestern. And I don't think coaches go into games going, we need to cover the spread today. But the fact that they didn't cost Oregon spots in the poll. And I don't think Oregon, for a second consecutive week, is going to want to go in there going, well, we didn't cover the spread 2 weeks in a row. Is this a problem? Like, are we not that good? I don't know if they care about it or not, but coaches know what the point spreads are. Don't let them tell you any different. I've had multiple coaches, including Jonathan Smith once upon a time at Oregon State, you know, and I had picked, you know, I made my weekly picks, and Smith always went online at johnconzano.com. He was a subscriber, so was Dan Lanning, and he would read the picks, and he would text me later going, oh, you don't like us, huh? You don't like us against the spread. I mean, I think coaches know this stuff, but 35, and I mean, I'm not surprised it jumped up because I would have jumped all over it at, you know, 27.5 as well.
Number two.
Well, speaking of the AP poll, that is number two as the AP poll has come out. Top five right now, Ohio State, Penn State, LSU, Miami, and Georgia. That does, in fact, mean that the Oregon Ducks fell two spots from number four to number six. Florida State, 7, Texas, 8, Illinois, 9, Texas A&M, after their big win over Notre Dame, they round out the top 10. Now, some interesting notes in the AP poll. Utah, who we've been all over this year, John, they move up to number 16. Seems about right. Georgia Tech, after beating Clemson, they move up to 18. They join the top 25. Notre Dame falls to 24 after starting out 0-2. You know, playing Miami and Texas A&M, you're losing to two really good teams. I still think they might even be a top 15 team in the nation. You just play these teams and you're going to lose. USC has made an appearance. They are number 25. South Carolina, they have fallen out of the poll. And we always talk about this. There's always the question of, like, what top 10 team preseason is going to fall out of the poll by the end of the year.
Yeah.
Well, we already have one. Clemson, preseason number 4. They are already out of the top 25 AP poll. Some interesting stuff there going on.
Yeah, Oregon dropping, probably a bit more by virtue of the fact that maybe the voters didn't watch the game. Maybe they didn't know Oregon had seconds and thirds in the game when Northwestern finally started moving the ball late. I don't know. I agree with Roy, who called in earlier in the show, though. I did see Northwestern, when they ran the football, have a little success against Oregon. And it made me think that Penn State, who's going to try to bloody that game up on, you know, coming up in a couple of weeks, that Penn State has to be watching that game going, oh, you know, that is our recipe. Remember, Penn State put up more than 300 rushing yards against Oregon in the Big Ten championship game. That game in State College.
Number three.
Some NFL teams and fans are nervous right now as their teams are facing some quarterback issues. As the Bengals, Joe Burrow, he suffered a grade 3 turf toe injury, John. It's going to require surgery, sideline him at least 3 months. Jake Browning, the former UW Husky, will take over in that spot. J.J. McCarthy, the second-year pro for the Minnesota Vikings, he's going to be out 2 to 4 weeks with an ankle injury. Carson Wentz, former Eagle, will start for the Vikings. And Jaden Daniels of the Commanders has a knee injury. Adam Schefter says he is iffy for week 3. They still don't know. We're going to go about throughout practice this week. But if he can't go, former Duck Heisman Trophy winner Marcus Mariota will start. So very injured quarterbacks here early on in the regular season.
Well, this is the name of the game in football. It's a quarterback-centric game. You've got to keep these guys healthy. It is a long season. But here come the Commanders. You know, they will be without the services maybe of Jaden Daniels. But this is why you invest in a Marcus Mariota. This is your contingency plan. This is what helps make you a successful NFL organization because, you know, they had Mariota come in last season. He won 2 games for them, Steven, as a starter. He'll be here possibly earlier this season.
Number four.
Well, maybe teams need a quarterback. Maybe they should go after Tom Brady. Tom Brady coming out of retirement of sorts. He will be joining the likes of other NFL stars, Saquon Barkley, Christian McCaffrey, among others, in a Fanatics Flag Football Classic, which is going to be a competitive flag football tournament taking place in the Riyadh season in Saudi Arabia on March 21st of 2026. Now, Pete Carroll, Sean Payton, Kyle Shanahan, they are going to be the coaches of the three teams. The event will feature 3 teams of 8 players facing off in a round-robin tournament with the top 2 teams advancing to the championship. This event will air on Fox and Tubi with Kevin Hart as the host. This also goes with the announcement that WWE announced WrestleMania 43 is going to be in Saudi Arabia during the Riyadh season as well. So when's the Super Bowl? Heading over to Saudi Arabia for the Riyadh season.
Well, I'll tell you this. This radio show will not be doing a remote broadcast in Saudi Arabia. We're not going to go there. We're not going to do that. But it appears, though, everything is for sale. What's that they say? They say, how much are they going to pay for that? Well, then somebody will probably send me over there to do the remote broadcast. But I think in the end, you've got the Saudis trying to buy all this sports stuff. They're trying to sports wash their human rights records. We know that. Came up with the LIV golf tournament, tour. It's now coming up in more mainstream ways. I think we would all be surprised if we found out how much Saudi investment there is in NFL and Major League Baseball and NBA teams. I think people would be shocked to know that the money is finding its way into the professional sports franchises, and certainly you're going to see Tom Brady throwing passes in Saudi Arabia.
Number 5.
Well, the WNBA, they started their playoff season yesterday, and now the Golden State Valkyries, the expansion team, they're going to host their first playoff game against the Minnesota Lynx, but it won't be at Chase Center, which they sold out for every game this season. They have to go 50 miles away to San Jose, to the SAP Center, because of the Laver Cup tennis tournament has already been scheduled there, and they can't do anything about it. Scheduling
Laver,
conflict.
Laver Cup.
The Laver. Whatever, you know.
Come on.
I know.
Come on.
Yeah, whatever. But Valkyries were good this year at home. 14-8. Outscored their opponents by 6 points. Kind of sucks for them that they're losing that home court advantage. It's really good, and the Chase Center was loud for them. So I feel kind of bad for them.
Yeah, I feel bad for them. Are you really gonna feel bad for the Valkyries? This is your team?
Yeah, dude.
You're going now?
I mean,
thing?
They literally just thought they were gonna suck this year because they're expansion team. So they're like, we can bring the tennis tournament in. Then you're good. Come on.
And then
that's the thing. The WNBA doesn't. They don't get it right. They don't get it.
Yeah, there's some problems there. Not prioritized. All right, we're leading you right into football tomorrow. It's going to be a dynamite show. Can you keep this between us? If you're listening right now, you're going to get a little secret. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock, Scott Barnes, Oregon State AD, he's reached out to me. He wants to come on the show. What does he want to talk about? If you're listening now, you are in on the secret. Membership has its privileges, as they say. So be here right at 3 o'clock tomorrow for Scott Barnes, Oregon State AD.